Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to retired Professor Adrian Bustamante. Right now, I'd like to welcome John Kessel, also Professor Emeritus of History at the University of New Mexico, and he will be speaking tomorrow night, Wednesday, at 6:30 at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Art. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Glad to be here.
So today is History Day, and it's all in honor of the 400th anniversary of Santa Fe. Santa Fe has been around a lot longer than the United States of America, and we thought that maybe you and I could start talking about New Mexican history, if we can even call it that, history of this area, at the first point where the people who were living here, the native people of this area, came in contact with the Spanish. Who was the first Spaniard they saw, and what was he doing here?
Well, the first Spaniard to invade the interlocking world of the native peoples in the Southwest was Francisco Vázquez de Coronado, who led a large expedition, so probably upwards of 400 mounted Spaniards, three times as many formidable Mexican Indian allies, into the Southwest in 1542, and greatly disrupted the Pueblo world. What he found here was perhaps 70,000 Pueblo Indians in as many as 100 different communities, speaking half a dozen different languages, and he greatly disrupted their balance of power. But because he could find nothing to make this area pay, given the markets and demands of his day, he withdrew, almost as if he'd never been here.
What was he looking for?
He was looking for a large population that could be set to mining, digging, cultivating, something profitable, and that he didn't find. He found the Pueblo population, which, unlike the surrounding semi-nomadic tribes, was settled, was in pueblos that the Spaniards, as Europeans, could recognize as towns, hence the name Pueblo Indian, towns. But there wasn't anything here to... And this theme of poverty is going to play all the way through the colonial period in New Mexico. He finds nothing to make it pay. He withdraws.
Leaving a big mess.
Yes, indeed. And one of the things he did note, and the archaeological record had previously testified, that this was no native Eden before rapacious Europeans broke in on it.
Right.
The Pueblos were fighting each other and fighting others. And so, yeah, he disrupted their balance of power. But he talked about how he came to a large Pueblo that had been destroyed during their wars. So he leaves, and the northern frontier of New Spain, moving north from Mexico City, falls back on itself. But then word of these people, these clothed town-dwelling people, get back. This word gets back to Mexico City, and there is further excitement, and several expeditions come north. And in 1583, the king in Spain decrees that New Mexico be colonized. They're not using the word conquest anymore. They're using pacification. Doesn't mean a darn thing. But Juan de Oñate is the successful contractor in colonization who, in 1595, signs a contract with the king's representative in Mexico City, the viceroy. And a bunch of delays, but he gets up here in 1595. So Pueblo lookouts look down there, and they see these Spaniards moving up the Rio Grande Valley. Pretty large bunch, not as large as Coronado's, but obviously a different kind. These were people, these were migrants. They were looking for a new home. And so...
So they were migrants, a different thing than conquerors.
Yes, and I think you can make that distinction between the explorers who, had they found something, probably would have settled. But they didn't find anything to make it pay. So here we're trying again. Oñate is a mine developer. He has 600 or 700 colonists with him, but they're women and children and breeding mares and livestock and
right.
cuttings of trees. Obviously, he's come to found a colony. But he is a mine developer, and what he wants is to find mines. And for about 9 years, the assay reports keep coming in empty. And Oñate has to say the same thing. Poverty has overwhelmed us. He had a consortium that had got together to invest in this northern venture, this enterprise of New Mexico. And he had to admit, in the same year that Jamestown is founded, Juan de Oñate resigns his governorship of New Mexico. Wise heads say, the place isn't worth colonization. Let's withdraw the colonists and the few Pueblo Indians who have been Christianized, who've been baptized. Well, the Franciscans get wind of this, and it would seem to me that they exaggerate mightily, and suddenly in 1608 come up with the figure of more than 7,000 Pueblo Indians baptized. Well, you can't withdraw that many, and so the crown makes the decision, and I'm not sure any other colonial power would have done this, to maintain New Mexico, which had been an estate of the Oñates, if you will, a proprietorship. They now change it to New Mexico's status to a government-subsidized Franciscan ministry to the Pueblo Indians. So there's a huge change there.
Interesting.
And again, it's poverty. And had Oñate's dream of wealth and a bonanza, had that materialized, there would have been an enormous rush to the north that might have overwhelmed the Pueblo peoples. But poverty, again, saved them, in a sense. And you have three generations of New Mexico as mainly a Franciscan ministry to the Pueblo Indians.
Now, did the Pueblo people find themselves having to defend themselves? I mean, what was the nature of, was there violent hostility against them, or what was the nature of the relationship that was happening?
Both. Large Pueblo of Pecos, which had been attacked by a renegade expedition that came up between Coronado and Oñate, chose not to contest the Spaniards coming in. Acama, another seemingly aggressive Pueblo, decided, yes, we will challenge these Spaniards, and they, circumstances are clouded, but they kill Oñate's nephew and second-in-command and a dozen of his men. This in that same year, 1598. Early in 1599, there's a fierce three-day battle at Acama. Somehow, miraculously, the Spaniards come out on top. I wonder if they had other Pueblos as auxiliaries. Big
yeah.
question. But nevertheless, they do manage to hang on in 1599. There is peripheral hostility with the Salinas Pueblos down the other side of the Manzano Mountains. And a few others, but largely the Spaniards are here. Because of the poverty, the Camino Real, 1,500 miles from Mexico City up here, never becomes an emigrant route. I mean, there's no reason for people to come up here. So the Hispanic population grows very slowly. Meantime, mainly because of disease, not because of necessarily because of Spanish oppression, but mainly because of disease that they were
European diseases that they didn't have immunity against.
Exactly, exactly. And about every 10 to 15 years, a major epidemic strikes, and it's likely to be smallpox in conjunction with flu and measles, and these are killers. So as the Hispanic population grows very, very slowly to maybe 2,500 by 1680, three generations later, the Pueblo population has started a deep decline. Where probably Oñate was accurate, quite accurate, the anthropologists say, when he estimated in 1599 that there were about 60,000 Pueblo Indians in that year. By 1680, probably 20,000.
Oh, my heavens.
A two-thirds decline. Interesting statistic, however, is if you look at the 2000 U.S. Census, in 1599, Oñate says 60,000. Our census in the year 2000 says 59,621. They haven't gone away. And again, it, I think, is largely that poverty and no reason for that many Spaniards to overwhelm the and so, and it's interesting, during this time, Pueblos and Hispanos maintain their cultural integrity. There is some intermarriage. There certainly is miscegenation.
Meaning intermixing.
Yeah, there's
marriage between the Spaniards and the Indians.
But it's kind of interesting because it would seem that a child perhaps born of a Hispanic man and a female Pueblo domestic in his house, it was decided whether that child would grow up in the house of the Spaniard or back in the Pueblo. So there was this remarkable maintenance of cultural integrity on both sides, which has allowed it to come down to today. And that's one of the, I think, remarkable things about this 400th commemoration.
We're talking to Professor Emeritus John Kessel, Professor of History, formerly at the University of New Mexico, and he'll be speaking tomorrow night at 6:30 at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Art right here in Santa Fe. So we've just kind of covered the whole 17th century practically.
Well, that brings us up to what my subject is tomorrow night.
Yes.
I call the talk "A Long Time Coming, the 17th Century Pueblo-Spanish War." And my main question is, if the Spaniards were so utterly heinous, brutal, uniquely cruel, and
evil torturers in every way.
Exactly. Why did it take the Pueblos three generations to get it together and revolt and cast the Spaniards out? And It is an interesting story, and I tend to talk about the Pueblo-Spanish War rather than the Pueblo Revolt as a separate event and Vargas's recolonization as a separate event. They are definitely linked, and if you look at the stunningly successful Pueblo Revolt of August 1680, as the first and swiftest act of the Pueblo-Spanish War, within 6 weeks, the Spaniards had fled, leaving 400 of their brethren dead up here in New Mexico, and the Pueblos were independent for a dozen years. That interim period is the second act of the Pueblo-Spanish War, where you've got the Spanish refugees in exile in the El Paso area, and the Pueblos upriver now rid, for the time being, of their colonial overlords. So what do? They begin to fight among themselves again, which, of course, is going to be the opening for the third act, which...
Well, I mean, here's the question. So when, as you say, when the Spanish first got there, they found a delicate balance of power. Did they unify quickly against the Spanish? In other words, did people from all the various pueblos in this area say, okay, we may have our problems, but we are definitely against these people over there?
It took three generations to get there.
It
took three generations to get there. And when you think of it, I mean, the Pueblo world is divided among six different languages.
Right.
And
so they didn't even understand each other? I mean, were they as different as Chinese and English?
I don't think so. I think there were definite dialects, and certainly the documents speak of a number of polyglot Pueblo Indians who spoke six languages, and so, and just because you shared a language didn't mean that it assured harmony.
Peace.
I mean, a good example is Taos and Picuris. I mean, they're traditionally rivals, but they speak the same Northern Tewa language. And so the Spaniards cleverly used Pueblo Indian auxiliaries against other Pueblos. But
along the lines of the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yes. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. And so what happens is gradually, as the semi-nomadic peoples, the non-Christian peoples surrounding New Mexico, the Apaches, Navajos, Utes, begin to adapt to the horse and begin to raid fearsomely on the agriculturalists, whether they're Hispanos or Pueblos, you have the Spaniards fairly early on recruiting mixed groups of Pueblo auxiliaries to fight against the common enemies of the kingdom. And gradually, I mean, it's almost without exception that these groups of Spaniards that go out against the Apaches and Navajos are greatly outnumbered by the Pueblo Indians who are with them. Gradually, these Pueblo Indians are not only gaining confidence, but at the same time, they are becoming accustomed to each other. And so that is certainly one thing. Retired professor Cal Riley has pointed out, among others, that this recruiting these Pueblo Indians as fighters was risky to the Spaniards in the long run, because if they ever pulled it together, and somehow Pope was able to do that. There was another attempt at a Pueblo revolt 10 years earlier, in 1670. And one of the other questions I'm asking is, what did Esteban Clemente, who tried to pull together the Pueblo revolt 10 years earlier, get wrong that Pope got right 10 years later? So, interesting questions.
What are some of your answers to that question?
Well, one of the things is this Esteban Clemente, who's hardly mentioned in New Mexico history, was the most Hispanicized and trusted Pueblo Indian in the entire kingdom.
Trusted by the Spanish.
Trusted by the Spaniards, yeah. And so he, who had for years recruited Pueblo war captains to join the Spaniards and go out on campaign with them, apostatizes and suddenly is asking those same Pueblo war captains to join him in a rebellion against the Spaniards. Now, who's going to trust him?
Right.
And
right.
So it And besides, he tried to pull it off in the spring, not a good time, and things were horrible in New Mexico at the time. So this combined business, Pope cleverly, and the greatest advantage he had over Clemente was no Spaniard knew who he was. Nobody knew who this guy was until after the fact. And he was able, of course, to pull it together by, I think, skillful negotiation and fear. Join us or else. There's no question that later witnesses say that they feared Pope. Of course, that was self-serving. We did it.
Yeah, we were scared. That's why we did it.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you have this whole phenomenon that you're calling the Pueblo-Spanish War.
Yes.
When did it all settle out?
The third act, which is invited by Pueblo Disunion, is the restoration under Diego de Vargas. And of course, Vargas makes a trip up here that really is a reconnaissance. What he takes over as governor is the colony in exile in El Paso. It's a mess, it's miserable. And he manages to, in 1692, bring a small force up here, no women and children, and through skillful diplomacy, he is able to, in an only ritual sense, restore New Mexico, to repossess New Mexico for Spain. But then he takes the whole group back to El Paso and says that New Mexico is restored. That's what fiestas commemorate, is 1692, this alleged bloodless reconquest. But it was only ritual. When he came back with all his baggage and women and children and the whole bunch, the Tehuantinos, who had built a pueblo right over the top of the governor's palace, said, no way, we're not going out in the cold. It was December, it was fierce weather. So Vargas had to fight for Santa Fe in 1693, and it was bloody. So there were two aspects. But once the Spaniards, very last days of 1693, did restore Santa Fe, they were gradually able to, with the aid of Pueblo Indians, who for their own good reasons decided that rule by one of their own didn't offer as much security promise as the colonial regime. And they were actually willing to join with Vargas and swing the tide. And so in 1696, there was a second Pueblo revolt, just as intense, just as passionate, and just as fatal for those five Franciscans who died and some 20 colonists, but not widespread. Vargas was able to rely on Pueblo Indian auxiliaries against those resistors and was able in 1696 to put down and really claim the restoration of New Mexico. And so the Pueblo-Spanish War, which breaks out violently in 1680, ends before 1696. And so it is a story that's connected and not necessarily broken up.
So we really only have a few minutes left, but we've only gotten as far as the beginning of the 18th century. But what happens to the native people in the 18th century, which is a long time, but we don't have that much time to go over it right now. Are there any more revolts?
No, there is no further large-scale conflict between Pueblos and Spaniards. The purpose of the colony changes, however. We're in a more secular age, and whereas the justification for spending more than 2 million pesos on New Mexico in the 17th century was mainly missionary, in the 18th century, it's mainly military, because think what's happening in North America. You have the rivalry of the French, the Brits, then the Russians, and New Mexico is mid-continent, it becomes a military bulwark. And so, yes, it's still government subsidized. Yes, it's still poor. But the reason the Crown is keeping New Mexico going is now military instead of missionary. So there's a real change in the 18th. As far as the Pueblo Indians are concerned, their population bottoms out at about 10,000 and then starts gradually growing again. So that by the mid-century, 1750, you have as many Pueblo Indians as you do Hispanos in the Rio Grande Valley. And that really causes a change in human relations. If there are as many of us as there are of you, you tend not to be so arrogant. And outside, you've got the Comanches and others raiding New Mexico. And so the old business of the codependence, the defensive codependence, is put back in place. And all through the century, you have Spanish expeditions going out, campaigning, but always with more Pueblo Indians than there are Hispanos on those campaigns. So it's an accommodation in the 18th century.
What kind of cultural mixing do you have?
I think that as far as cultural mixing, it doesn't change a lot from the 17th century, and you still have the maintenance of pretty clear cultural identity on both sides, on the Pueblo side and the Hispanic side. Sure, there's a lot of mixture, and there are as many blacks in New Mexico as there are in any other high elevation area. They're much more prevalent in the Caribbean and the tropical areas, but up here, so there was every mix, but still there was the fiction that you were either Pueblo or Spanish.
John Kessel is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of New Mexico, and once again, he'll be speaking tomorrow night, Wednesday, at 6:30 at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Art. He's the author of many books, including the one I have in my hand right here called Pueblos, Spaniards, and the Kingdom of New Mexico. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been a pleasure.
We're going to take a little break right now, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR.